G'day, Jonathan Green here. Blueprint for Living, a highlights package for you. And today, architecture mimicking nature. We get to know our nuts. And we talk to the author of Meatonomics. But first, a nature fix. Here's a quote for you. Between two pine trees is a door leading to a new life. Now, that's naturalist, author, environmental philosopher John Muir. Here's another one, Tiptoe Through the Tulips. That's Tidy Tim, just to give you something by way of contrast. What if nature, that's what we're talking about there, the simplicity of the outdoors, what if it could do more than simply lift our spirits? What if deep down it actually changed our deepest psychological wiring? Now, that quote, the John Muir one, not Tiny Tim, that pops up in a new book by Florence Williams, an American writer, and it's called The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier and More Creative. Florence joins us from Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, we know this instinctively, that feeling of well-being in the natural world.
That's right. We know it instinctively, but I tell you what, we actually undervalue it. That's what the research shows. We tend to think other things will boost our moods, like eating a pint of ice cream or streaming Netflix or going shopping. And we don't really value the benefits of nature. So that's one of the projects of my book. I really wanted to point to the research that shows that it can actually change our brains, affect our moods, make us healthier in much more profound ways than we realize.
And that research is really interesting and really concrete. Before we get to that, the interest here, I think, for you was sparked in your own life change, moving from Colorado, the wilds there, the ready access to nature, to beautiful downtown inner city Washington.
That's right.
And how did that affect you?
Well, I had lived in the beautiful, idyllic Rocky Mountains for over two decades, and my husband took a job in Washington, D.C. And so we moved one very, very hot summer day, July day, into this, you know, hyper-urban environment where there were, asphalt buildings everywhere, very loud, overflying jets, terrible traffic. And what happened was I kind of flipped out, you know, on some level. I felt like this cortisol bomb, this stress bomb went off in my brain. I wasn't sleeping so well. I was anxious. You know, I would burst into tears in these traffic circles. And I just started to think about what I had lost, you know, in terms of my almost, you know, daily or hourly connection with nature. And then, you know, what did that mean for our brains when we switch environments like that?
What you'd lost and what you'd barely recognized having when you were in the thick of it.
That's right. I didn't really appreciate it until it was gone and until I started to feel so unhinged and really missing my nature fix. So then I wanted to explore the science, you know, and what it was saying about what I was feeling.
And the science is interesting, although, as you point out in the book, hard to sort of pin down into, you know, really rigorous studies. And yet, neuroscientists are piecing together some really significant things that happen to us in the natural world.
Yeah, that's right. The neuroscientists are now really able to take pictures of the brain, see what's happening inside the brain when we're in different environments. So for part of this book, I actually wore a portable EEG cap, which looks like a bathing cap on my head, in different settings. And I started to learn what the scientists were finding out. And that is really that parts of our brain, in our sort of urban everyday lives get kind of overused, like our frontal cortex. That's the part of our brains that are, you know, constantly checking off our to-do lists and looking for parking spaces and multitasking with our devices. And then when we go into nature, what happens is that part of our brain sort of takes a little break. It quiets down. Other parts of our brains get activated that are more associated with things like empathy, creativity, you know, long range, daydreaming and planning. And so in a way, nature, you know, is kind of this shortcut, a spiritual shortcut, something that we can access to make us feel better, improve our creativity without having to kind of necessarily learn the rigors of meditation.
And it does it physiologically as well, things like drops in blood pressure, for example.
Yeah, we can really measure these changes in our nervous systems. So blood pressure drops, our heart rate variability changes, our cortisol stress hormones drop off. And as a consequence, we begin to feel calmer, more relaxed, and our moods boost as well.
Why? I mean, how does what actually influences the brain and the body in that way about the natural world?
It probably has to do with the way our perceptual systems perceive stimuli. So our brains evolved in a natural setting. We evolved to process information from water, from vegetation, from weather. You know, these are what our brains are sort of optimized for. And so when we're in this environment, there's something that happens subconsciously where our brains are kind of in their sweet spot. You know, they're in their happy place.
what we're talking about here is The Nature Fix, which is the title of a new book by American writer Florence Williams. You're on Blueprint for Living. And what I'm wondering, Florence, too, I mean, you say this is the brain's happy place. Okay, so are we just not built? Are we not wired to live in these urban environments? Is that, are we retreating to what we find natural and comfortable?
I think that's an important question. You know, humans are incredibly adaptable. So we can live in these different environments, but maybe we're not doing it as well as we could be. You know, we're not necessarily giving ourselves the rest or the breaks, you know, that our brains need. Mm-hmm. I do think it's possible to live a happy, fulfilling life in a city. I love cities. But maybe we also need to recognize that our brains actually could use, you know, a little bit of an episode of looking at a tree or looking at a potted plant. And our bodies need to move and walk and swing from the trees when we're little. And these are things that, you know, we're just not getting enough of anymore. We're living in this epic disconnection from the natural world.
And maybe we've moved too quick. Maybe we've just gone into the city within half a dozen generations that humans have concentrated in concrete. It's a quick
That's
transition.
Right. It's a very quick transition, and it's one to which we are, I think, not paying enough attention. For example, if you look at our children today, the amount of time they spend outside compared to even my generation and then my parents' generation, there's been this just incredible, epic shift in how much time we're spending outside. And I just don't think we're remarking on it as much as we should be.
The other side of that is, of course, that we may adapt to this new way of living, that our minds, our sense of well-being may adjust to what the urban environment is doing to our psychology, to our brains as well.
We can adjust and we can adapt, but that hardwiring is many, many, many hundreds of thousands of years old. And it's not something that's really going to change overnight. So I think we need to just figure out how to kind of optimize, you know, these new environments that we find ourselves in.
Well, and presumably we can do that in the urban environment. I mean, this is the importance of having green space in a city setting.
That's right. And I think this is a really important conversation for city planners to be having, for schools to be having, for housing developments. There are ways to integrate sort of biophilic design or integrate nature into these institutions, into our cities. And when we do that, we really find that our inhabitants may not only be happier, but they actually may get along better.
Some governments are kind of seeing the benefit of this. Now, tell us about this Japanese idea of forest bathing.
Yes, forest bathing, or Shinrin-yoku, as it's called, is a practice being promoted by the Japanese Forest Agency just in the last couple of decades. You know, Japan industrialized incredibly late and very quickly. People are working incredibly long hours there. They're being kind of shoved onto subways. You know, it's a stressful life. And they need a break. They need an outlet. And so the Forest Service is encouraging office workers and families to get out into nature and forest bathe. And so what that is it doesn't involve, you know, taking off your clothes and rolling around in the twigs. It really involves just engaging all of your senses. So being really mindful and putting your phone down, listening to the birds, looking at the fractal patterns in the leaves or the branches. Hmm. And what happens when you can engage your five senses, that really can be a shortcut for calming down our nervous systems.
And it's that thing of engaging all the senses, as you say. I mean, like listening, having that sense of quiet and yet, oh, little bird. that true engagement rather than the bombardment, the sort of the passivity that we have sensually in the city.
That's right. And sound is a really interesting example because, if anything, we've conditioned our ears not to hear everything in the city. We don't want to hear the city. And so we walk around with our earbuds on. You know, we really create our own soundscape. Mm. And because of that, we may be actually losing our ability to discern kind of subtle sounds.
You're hearing the subtle sound of Florence Williams. She's written a book called The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative. I'm wondering about this, Florence, too, is how we untangle the many different things. So if I go for a walk in the forest, I'm exercising, for one thing. Yes, I'm in that forest, I'm in that open environment. But how do I work out whether is it the physical effort that's making me feel better? Is it the place that I'm in that's making me feel better? Is it the sort of meditative state that I get into, not having to think about things, focusing on the moment, being mindful? Is that what's making me feel better? How do we sort out just what it is?
I think you've really hit upon an essential and sort of challenging question. I wondered the same thing. I thought, well, maybe, you know, this isn't just an exercise effect. And so when I went to Japan, I thought, well, maybe the forest bathing works just because people are outside exercising, walking around. But the scientists thought of that, too. They sent similar groups of subjects to walk around in a city and to walk around in kind of different levels of nature. And they really only found these kind of nervous system benefits and these mood benefits in the groups that walked in the more forested areas.
I mean, it's a terrible conflict, isn't there, in our world between the need to make urban space, to make money out of open land, and then that need to keep that. And to see the value in that open country is it often a hard thing?
I think that we tend to think now of nature as being a luxury. You know, it's something for people who can afford to put their houses on the coast or on the golf course, and that's nice for them. Mm. But what the science is now showing is that really this is essential. It's essential for kind of being our best human selves, for really making us civilized. And so I think that's kind of an interesting contradiction, that we need nature to be civilized.
And yet civilization has always been about the repression of nature, about the subduing of nature, the paving over of nature.
Well, you know, it hasn't always been that way. I mean, even, you know, in ancient Mesopotamia, in ancient Persia, I think there was a lot of thought that went into, you know, designing gardens, for example, for people. We've always kind of encouraged, you know, wonderful parks and gardens, you know, again, especially if you had more resources. But I think now we are, you know, Frederick Law Olmsted, who designed Central Park in New York City, where I grew up, he really understood that it's all people, not just the wealthy, who need this in order even for democracy to function, for us all to be able to get along. And I think that's the level that we need to kind of really understand in order to move our cities to a livable place for the 21st century.
Yeah, a peace lily in the bathroom won't really cut it, will it?
Well,
I guess it's better than nothing.
But
is there a certain kind of environment? I mean, you know, the natural world is rich and varied place.
Is
a desert better for your brain than a rainforest?
What I found, it's so interesting, is there's a lot of variability, you know, among people. So I may love a forest, but someone else may love an ocean, whereas another person might feel really uncomfortable, you know, in the wide spaces of an ocean or a desert. So I think that there is a lot of variability. And in fact, this is interesting, too. There's a group of people, maybe 15% of people in a lot of these studies, who just will never be comfortable in nature. You know, they don't like the bugs, they don't like the wind, they get anxious, and they'll never relax.
What should be our routine here? I mean, if I go for a nice walk in the forest today, how long is that going to have an enduring benefit for?
That's another question that I think scientists are really just starting to tease out. I met one researcher in Japan who found that walks in the forest increased our immune cells, our killer T cells, you know, which are so important for fighting cancer and other diseases. And he believes that those killer T cells, the boost lasts for about 7 to 21 days.
Wow.
So his recommendation is you need to go at least once a week. But if you can only go every 21 days, you'll still get a little bit of an effect. And then in Finland, the researchers there say, we think you need 5 hours a month minimum dose in order to ward off depression. So that's pretty specific.
Not just good for the brain, but good for the body too. That this is an interesting thing. The smell from some trees might help your immune system.
That's right. Researchers in Japan are looking specifically at the aromatic compounds that certain kinds of evergreen trees emit, specifically these hinoki cypress trees that are all over Japan. And they really have this wonderful smell. It's kind of like a Christmas tree meets VapoRub. And it's very invigorating.
Yeah, it would be. I'm trying to work that out. I mean, I can't help get this out of my head, though, Florence, that maybe we've got it wrong. I mean, in the city, that there's so much for us in nature in that more simple world that is so much better for us as people. We've taken a wrong turning.
I think we have to be careful, though, not to be kind of overly nostalgic about, the way the world was, 100,000 years ago. It certainly wasn't always a friendly place.
We had bad teeth and terrible food.
We had bad teeth, incredible infant mortality, right? Lots of bloody animals to eat. I think that there are a lot of wonderful, wonderful benefits to living in a city, including better health care, better job opportunities, better opportunities for women, certainly. So, I think we just have to be smart about how we design our cities, how we live in them, and how we move forward from here.
And you're still in D.C., and you appear to be a happy, chirpy person.
That's because I had my walk this morning.
Florence, fascinating and I think something that a lot of us can incorporate pretty easily in our lives to great benefit. Thank you for pointing that out.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Florence Williams's book is The Nature Fix. I'm Jonathan Green. This is Blueprint for Living. Not so long ago in Australia, roast chicken. Now, that was a bit of a luxury. Go back even further, it was maybe an annual treat. Now, we buy chicken, any other sort of meat too, with a sort of abandon. Well, it used to be a special occasion. It isn't. Meat is as cheap as chips, if you'll excuse that mixed metaphor. What, though, is the true cost of the meat we buy? And is our reliance on that cheaper meat, is that detrimental not only to the environment, to the welfare of animals, to the health of our own bodies? Think about those things. We're going to talk them over. David Simon, he is a US-based lawyer. He's the author of Meatonomics. Now, he's been on a speaking tour of Australia, sponsored by the animal protection organisation Voiceless. And we're also joined by Craig Hinchliffe. Now, he is a lamb producer from the Grampians in beautiful Western Victoria. Welcome both. And can I begin with you, David? There's a subheading in your book, How the Rigged Economics of Meat and Dairy Make You Consume Too Much. Is that the key to our problem?
Well, I certainly think that that's a major part of the problem. One of the features with meat today is that producers are enabled to keep its price extremely low, which means that consumers end up buying more of it. It's sort of a basic economic principle, the law of demand. As prices go down, consumption goes up. And what we see both in Australia and in the US today is that consumers are consuming meat at a per capita rate that is among the highest in the world. And it's giving us all kinds of problems, personal health, environmental issues, animal ethical issues, and others.
How do we get that price so low?
I think it has to do with a combination of things, including subsidies and legislation that state and federal governments have passed, again, in both countries, that protect large factory farmers and allow them to offload the majority of their production costs onto society. Once they've offloaded those costs, they're allowed to lower their retail prices to consumers considerably.
Craig, how does that affect you? You're not a large factory farmer. I mean, do you find it difficult to get the true price for what you produce?
Yeah, no, it's very difficult for family farms. And I would say they're small to medium farms. So most farms now in Western Victoria, if you're 750 hectares or less and you're stuck in a commodity market to earn your living, you're really struggling. It's really tough. And part of the issue is, if you have an ethical production paradigm where you want to ensure that the lambs that you're producing are genuine pasture-fed lambs and they have lots of space and that you respect their herding and grazing instincts. The retail price is very tight because the supply chain now takes two-thirds of the profit. So I'm a fifth-generation farmer. When my grandfather was working and running this property, he would get about two-thirds of the end retail price for the product that he sold. And one-third would go to the supply chain, the processors, the retailers. Now, it's entirely the other way. So the share that the farmer can earn is much, much tighter. And that's driving people towards industrial production practices, which is unfortunate for the environment. It's unfortunate for the depletion of families in the rural areas of Australia, and it's bad for nutrition. Animals that are forced to be fed a lot in quite artificial, unhealthy environments just don't deliver the same nutrition. And so I guess part of the thing that I observe, and most of the farming families that are my neighbours, we observe is the sorts of food that we see in supermarkets, we wouldn't like to eat. You know, we just don't think that they're good-looking products, but they don't stack up nutritionally.
This is really interesting, David. I'm wondering if what you're hearing there is almost a description of the US a couple of decades back, if this is this is the way this changes.
Well, I would think that that's a common complaint among smaller to mid-sized farmers in the U.S. as well, that because once you internalize those production costs, and as Craig is doing, he's attempting to raise animals in a more ethical and healthier way than factory farmers can, it's that internalization of production costs that requires a farmer to pay for those things himself. And he has a challenging time offloading them onto consumers. I think that's why factory farmers have an advantage, unfortunately.
You argue that in the US that the meat industry is operating in many ways a similar way to big tobacco, the way it used to. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you know, one issue that we haven't touched on yet, but that I'll mention briefly, is that increasingly we're seeing some of the health effects of meat being called into question. The World Health Organization, for example, now lists red meat as a class 2A carcinogen, meaning it is probably carcinogenic to humans, and at least processed meat is a class 1 carcinogen, meaning it is known to be carcinogenic to humans. And I think one of the challenges that we're facing as we look for ways to both produce and consume meat in a sustainable way is we're sort of back where we were with tobacco in 1950 before its adverse health effects were acknowledged by the medical community and by policymakers. You know, in 1953, for example, Chesterfield cigarettes ran magazine ads that said Chesterfield has no known adverse effects when you smoke it. And then other ads said 9 out of 10 doctors prefer Chesterfields. So we're sort of at a place where, in order to allow smaller farmers like Craig and his affiliates to succeed, I think we need to lower our consumption levels of meat. It needs to be lowered to more sustainable levels. And I think in order to get there, we need to acknowledge some of these adverse health effects so that people simply understand that the more they eat, the worse it is for them.
I think you'd be on side with this, wouldn't you, Craig? I mean, the adverse health effects come by and large through overconsumption, and I'm guessing that if we consumed less but paid more for it, and if it was of good quality, that would please people like you.
Absolutely, and it sounds quite counterintuitive. You know, a family farm that produces lamb, thinking that, you know, it'd be good if consumers ate less. But that's exactly right. We'd actually like to see people buying food based on nutritional information. And what we would argue is if you really knew the nutritional profile of the meat in the display cabinets, you would turn away and very quickly go and order directly from the farmer, where you have confidence and full traceability as to how those animals were cared for and actually were produced. And I would say one little thing about subsidy, and that's quite true. A lot of the food in Australia today is subsidised, but it's by the invisible farmers. And that is the working spouses, the teachers, the nurses, the people that earn off-farm income. to enable these small family farms to continue. That's a form of subsidy. And the people that are receive the most benefit from that are probably the consumer and the big supermarkets and value chains that take most of the profit from the food chain. Mm. But it's very interesting, and I feel that there's a lot of good points in what David has written. As controversial as it will be for many people in the farming and community, even here in Australia.
We're looking at the true cost of meat here on Blueprint. Craig Hinchliffe, he's a fifth-generation farmer, Western Victoria. David Simon is the author of Meatonomics. I want to get to Craig's experience and family experience over time, but David, first, that issue of subsidy and the political clout, I guess, of big agriculture is substantial and perhaps distorts a lot of farming production, a lot of consumer behaviour as well.
That's completely true. And as Craig said, they're not only sort of the direct and known subsidies, but there are indirect subsidies. And I would argue that many of these production costs that are offloaded onto taxpayers and consumers are yet another form of invisible subsidy. And in order to really address this issue, I think we're going to have to figure out ways to make factory farmers internalize those costs and stop offloading them and stop seeking subsidies from government and from others in the industry.
Tell us about this, Craig. Go back over those five generations, and how has that process of production changed?
There's a term called a declining terms of trade, and essentially, as my great-great-grandfather, when he arrived, there was here in Western Victoria in 1852, there was quite an increased demand. The demand was greater than supply, and the ability for food producers to be able to set prices was much more available in the whole economic construct during that period. And over successive generations, we've seen more and more production or more land clearance, increased production in other parts of the world, and we've seen increasing costs in highly developed countries. We've had the price of labour is going up exponentially. All of the input costs, such as diesel fuel, fertilisers, are increasing at very rapid rates. Mm. But our country, our environment, actually can't carry more animals. You know, we can do things to artificially stimulate production, but true profitability lies in finding that nice balance, those environmental balances that enable us to continue to sustain what we're doing. And we can't afford to mine the environment in which we live. So I guess when we do a bit of research and we see the changes that climate change is having, we see global trade expanding exponentially, really low costs of shipping. There's a new dimension to ethical food production now, and also accountability and traceability. So The small farms here in Western Victoria, a century ago, were only really competing with other food producers within a radius of 100 kilometres. Today, it's very much a global phenomenon. And Australia, and I guess America, runs this risk as well, is we've really had a decline in our manufacturing sector because we just couldn't compete against the efficiencies and the low input costs of other countries. And I think agriculture is being dragged in the same direction. The price of well-intended regulation is phenomenal. And a hidden cost is the price we pay for so few corner market stores now and so few small processors. The distortion of the value of the food value chain by really big players like supermarkets and the big agribusiness companies that own the processing facilities. They are the real price takers, and that's the biggest change over the generations.
And I guess, David, that's where another big change comes too in those supermarkets, which is the consumer expectation, the expectation that I can walk in there and I can buy that lamb at a ridiculous price, never mind that it's factory produced, that it's not good for me, it's cheap. And is that the expectation we need to deal with?
Yes, that's a continuing problem. Lamb prices I'm not familiar with because it's not as important a commodity in the U.S., but we know that with chicken, the prices of chicken have fallen 70%, the retail price on an inflation-adjusted basis in 70 mm-hmm. years. And as those prices have come down 70%, people have increased their consumption five or sixfold, which shows that they are entirely responsive to those price cues. Consumers are rational actors, and they will respond to price. And as long as prices stay unreasonably and artificially low, people will continue to consume meat, not just chicken, but lamb and other forms of meat at unhealthy and unsustainably high levels.
So there you go, consumers. If you want to do something about this, if you want to do something about environment, about the welfare of small ethical farmers, the health of your body, the welfare of animals, well, make some decisions in the supermarket. That might make a difference. Thanks to David Simon. He's a US lawyer. He's the author of Meatonomics. Craig Hinchliffe is a lamb producer, five generations of his family working the lands of Western Victoria in the Grampians region. And this is Blueprint for Living. Here's a question for you. What do termites know about architecture? Let me turn that around. What do architects know about termites? Well, in the case of the man you're about to meet, a significant amount. Now, Mick Pierce, he's a Zimbabwe-based architect. He has dedicated much of his professional life to creating buildings that take fundamental design principles from the natural world. We're going to introduce you to the idea of biomimicry. Mick joins us from Zimbabwe via Skype. Welcome.
Hi.
Fascinating word, an interesting word, biomimicry. Explain the thought behind that word to us.
It's when you study processes in nature and you copy the processes to inspire design.
Because when I think about nature and design, you're not replicating shapes. As you say, you're talking about a deeper level of process.
That's right. In the case of the termites, they build buildings. And what fascinates me is that they are blind and they live in the world of pheromones, which is like smell. Mm. So their senses are quite different. Because the pheromone evaporates, the architect for the termites is probably the air movement or the sun. And so the building they make is an interaction or a sort of a shape shaped by the natural forces acting on the building process.
What do those buildings do for the termites? What's their purpose and how are they functioning for the termites that live in them?
Well, the species that I watched a lot here in Zimbabwe, not quite like the ones in Darwin, they're an open chimney. And when you look down into them, you see thousands of creatures enjoying an environment which really suits them. They have no clothes. So unlike us, they have to air condition the city in which they live. Now, actually, that's quite a good idea. If we air conditioned our cities, we would save a huge amount of energy. And you can do that, actually, with trees and not with air conditioning plants.
You mentioned the Eastgate Centre in Harare, one of your buildings, and one of the buildings inspired by what you're describing now, the way in which termites create their home. Can you make the link for us? What did you mimic? What did you take into that centre?
Well, they make these towers, which are open at the top. So they work like chimneys. And the chimneys appear September, October, November, when the air gets hotter and hotter, just before the rains. And the problem for the termites is that when the air is about the same temperature as their nest, which is 31, the movement of air from underground castles where they live, the nest where they live, stops moving because there's no buoyancy. Mm-hmm. They rely on a difference between the temperature inside the nest and the outside temperature. And when that stops flowing, they start to suffocate during the day. At night it drops, so they get movement again. But during the day they need to enhance the movement of air, and they do that by building a chimney. And the top of the chimney is shaped to catch prevailing winds. So Eastgate uses night air to cool the building. And it does this by sucking night air into the building and blowing it through sort of very primitive heat exchangers under the floors of the offices, which are like sort of concrete teeth. And the air at night is driven by fans, which cause 12 air changes during the night to blow out the previous day's heat. Mm. And then during the following day, the teeth cool the air coming in. And this way we get about 4 degrees of cooling in the office with a day or a shift of temperature, day and night temperature of about 10. But the result is that you save a huge amount of energy. Mm.
So in Council House 2 in Melbourne, also, you know, use here of biomimicry as a design principle. Tell us about that.
Well, Melbourne is a different climate, and we have to use a different form of thermal store. In Melbourne, we're using phase change materials in the basement, which are rather like the thing you put in your esky when you go fishing. It's what some people call the ice pack that's frozen. In other words, it's a phase change material that stores cool at night and uses that to cool the building the following day. But the Melbourne building is designed to suit the Melbourne climate, which is far more difficult than the one we have here. And that's 37 degrees south. Melbourne's right down at sea level. So there's a very stark difference. But certainly a lot of the principles that I've gained from here we've used in Melbourne.
That building in Melbourne, part of its intention is to be a project which inspires others, there are lessons there which can be learned by other architects and developers. Do you see that happening?
Oh, yes, it did. It did. The star rating system was born while we were building CH2. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the big developers in Melbourne told me he would never build a building less than 5 stars in future after CH2. So there was it had a huge influence on development in Australia.
It's a tremendous thing that architects can do in responding to the challenges we face at the moment with climate change. There's a cost saving, obviously, but there's also a great saving in energy.
That's right. That's absolutely right. And, you know, there are many ways in which you can copy processes in nature, not just termites. The facades of Eastgate copy the cactus in the desert. It's full of prickles, which are very much more efficient at not absorbing solar energy during the day and getting rid of energy or heat at night. So, you know, it affects the look of the building and the way it responds to the winds and sunshine.
It's an interesting interplay that architecture has had with the natural world. It's in so many instances in sympathy, but in other instances sort of a dominating sort of artistic form. It's an interesting contradiction within the practice.
Yes, I tried to copy forms using sort of symbolic natural forms. I don't think that's really the way to go. The way to go is to work with science. And, you know, the way we interpret things going on in nature really helps to design. I mean, there's a very good example. If you study the heat in Melbourne and compare it with the outside temperature of around Melbourne, the countryside around Melbourne, the heat island effect in Melbourne is about 4 degrees hotter in Melbourne than outside. And that is mainly because of the efficient way in which trees disperse heat compared with flat surfaces that absorb heat and store it. So by growing trees in a city, you really reduce the ambient temperature, as well as the colour of the buildings.
Has this always been a part of your work, Mick, or was there a sort of a breakthrough moment where you saw a termite mound, you thought, what was that point?
Well, it started with actually an Australian coming to visit us here who invented permaculture. What's his name, Fish?
Bill Mollison.
Bill Mollison. Bill,
yes,
Mollison.
Indeed. Yes.
He said, well, Bill came here, and I'll never forget him standing on a stage and telling us how the natural rainforest works and how if we copied that with our agriculture, how it would change everything. And I thought, why don't we copy nature to build our cities? I mean, that was the first sort of message I got from Bill. And since then, you know, when one has followed nature and one has looked at nature in a different way, in the same way that Bill studied the rainforest and wondered why he was chopping down the trees and started to rethink the way in which we process farming, agriculture.
Well, an extraordinary development of some remarkable ideas. Thank you for sharing those thoughts, Mick Pierce. He's a architect based in Zimbabwe. He was the lead design architect for Melbourne's CH2 building, the Eastgate development in Harare in Zimbabwe that he's described. And yes, termites, cacti, all manner of biomimicry are involved in those structures. This is Blueprint for Living, mimicking nature here on RN. Time on Blueprint for Living for Know Your Onions, our weekly probe into vegetable matter. This week, the nut. Now, I don't think it would be going too far to say that today the nut is having a moment. It's true. It's the new, or perhaps rather old, superfood. Nuts are everywhere. Nut butters, nut milks, nut oils. How much, though, do we really know about nuts? I just learned, for example, that the peanut isn't, in fact, a nut. We have more fun facts for you. The crack Blueprint for Living fruit and veg team have gathered. Tim Entwistle, director of the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, Nikki Reimer, head chef at Bellotta, South Melbourne, and Penny Woodward, horticultural editor of ABC's Organic Gardener magazine. Tim, let's begin with you. Clear something up for us. What, in fact, is a nut?
Well, Jonathan, we spoke some time ago about fruits and how complex the definition of a fruit was.
They're not vegetables.
That's correct. Well, they can be vegetables. The same with a nut. A nut can be a whole range of things. But technically, to a botanist, it's a kind of fruit with one seed inside, a hard seed, and it doesn't break open. So it's sort of the outside breaks down eventually. That actually narrows it right down to just a few things like chestnuts, hazelnuts would botanically be a nut, but
what's a walnut?
Well, a walnut is it's a seed of a drupe. Now, a drupe to us botanists is actually a soft sort of fleshy fruit. So I think like an apricot and that kind of thing. So an almond and a walnut are seeds of a drupe. A Brazil nut or a peanut are just seeds. I mean, a peanut is the seed of a legume or a pea-like plant, and cashews are something entirely different. They're just a seed as well.
Where does the word come from?
Well, the nut is, well, I think it's a common term for, you know, a hard substance in the middle of a fruit. And botanically, I don't know where N-U-T came from, but it's always been used for that botanical definition.
Okay. Now, Nikki, we're going to cook these things.
Oh, yes.
So, should we always roast them before we cook them?
Look, I'm a fan of both techniques. I'm even a fan of blanching before I roast. I think that can also sort of help remove skins. I think a lot of times with things like walnuts, even with hazelnuts, you know, it's a nice technique that you can actually bring out more flavour of that inside of the nut. But now I'm technically not sure if I've ever been talking about nuts. I'm learning today, which is great. But I do feel that a lovely roasted nut adds to a recipe. For example, if you're making something like a dukkha mix, you know, which is lots of different nuts and seeds and spices, I always roast the nuts before because I think it adds a nicer crunch to it later.
And there's something about that flavour. I mean, there's a particular thing, that nuttiness, I guess.
Yeah, that nuttiness that we all love. Yeah. I think, as we all know, with cooking terms, we think that heat brings out flavours. So obviously something like roasting the nut will bring out the nuttiness flavour.
Do you have a favourite way with nuts?
I must admit, I like to use them a lot in sort of like, instead of a mayonnaise where you might use, you know, eggs and breads and things like that, I actually use nuts as thickenings. So something like a tarator sauce, like I love to puree my nuts. I know that sounds terrible, but, you know, it's a great technique and it makes really good sauces. You know, it's really good flavours in the sauces.
Is there any difference between banging them around in a mortar and pestle as opposed to doing them in a processor? Does that do anything to the composition of the thing?
Yeah, the processor's definitely going to get you a creamier result. But I love a mortar and pestle. I love that little bits of crunchiness in there still. You know, I don't want it all to one flavour in my mouth. I want those little bits of pieces that will taste different.
I had a recipe that I was cooking out of the newspaper the other day, which called for, you know, boiling your walnuts and then peeling them. And I decided halfway through that process that life was too short.
Yes. Although that's what kids are for, I've been told.
Is there a short way?
Oh, look, another trick that a lot of people use is obviously roasting them again into a pan and then wrapping them up in a tea towel and just bashing the tea towel, you know, like literally crushing the tea towel in your hand. And then when you open the tea towel up, the nuts will be broken up, but a lot of the skin is removed. But if you want to be more technical and have no skin, the boiling method is probably
And chestnuts better. Are another tricky-ish one.
Yes, they are a tricky-ish one. I've got many little wounds in my fingers from trying to get those devils out, I must admit. I love to buy a chestnut already out of the shell, so
yes,
to speak.
Yes, right.
I'm not going to lie there.
Nikki has given us a nuttish recipe, which we will pop up on the Blueprint website. Can you tempt us? What are we going to find?
We are actually going to make a tarator sauce. So it's one of my most favourite things to make. You can put it with steak, you can put it with fish, with vegetables. It's a Moroccan-style dish, actually. And it's like an aioli, but it's with nuts and lemon juice and extra virgin olive oil and a little bit of garlic. It's really good.
Check out our site, abc.net.au/rn. Look for Blueprint for Living. You'll find the recipes there. Penny Woodward, it is time to grow some. Now, not all of them. We're going to be selective.
Well, look, I thought I might just stick to almonds because we're getting huge acreages planted with almonds and they use a lot of water.
Are almonds nuts, Tim?
They definitely are, but sorry.
I check.
They definitely are when you go into a shop, but going back to the botanical definition, they're one of those seeds inside a droop, remember?
Okay. Yeah. Pennywood continues.
They're actually in the same family as roses. Almonds.
Is that right?
They are indeed.
Good in the Lord. In what the went rose wrong?
What went right?
Great combination. Almond and rose water.
So almonds need lots of sunlight. They need well-drained soil. If you've got heavy soil, plant them into a mound so the roots aren't sitting in lots of water. They like a bit of winter cold, but the thing that stops them from producing nuts more than anything else is frost at flowering time. We'll lose all those flowers and you won't get any almonds.
Well, that's an interesting path for them to choose. I mean, to like a bit of coldness but to hate the frost.
It is. You do wonder
contradictory
sometimes.
Contradictory of them.
But then they like hot, dry summers. Okay. But they do need a bit of water too in the production of the fruit. So it's a bit of a balance. The first year we moved into our place, we've got a grafted almond tree there and we got fabulous fruit for 2 years.
The various varieties?
There are. There's these days you want to get a self-pollinating one. And there's one called All in One and there's another one called Dwarf Paper Shell, which would both do well in slightly more confined areas.
Well, I was going to say, what sort of tree are we going to get as a result here?
Look, the classic tree is 3 metres by 3 metres. But if you get one of the old ones that doesn't self-pollinate, it could well get 5 or 6 metres by the same. They can be very big trees and actually beautiful trees.
I remember my grandmother had one in her backyard in Adelaide, which was tremendously productive and quite a big grand tree as well.
Yeah, they can be beautiful.
So frost is going to be your enemy. Can you protect against that?
To some extent, and it's better. Frost tends to be down at ground level. So once the trees get up a bit, you don't need to worry about it quite so much. So after 2 or 3 years, there's a chance that, you know, you won't have to put up with frost. But if you're growing it in an urban area, grow it somewhere where you get a bit of reflected heat from a nearby wall, or a bit of protection will often stop the frost.
Got some in the gardens, Tim?
Well, yeah, we have. And of course, we've got flowering blossom trees that are related as well. I was just thinking, as you're talking about heights, too, my favourite nut, which isn't a nut, is the pine nut. And it's a seed of a pine cone. Yes. But of course, the pine tree is, I don't know how many, 20, 30 metres high. So it's a little bit too big for the yard, I guess, Penny.
Has anybody ever grown a pine tree from a pine nut?
I'm sure they have.
Oh, yeah.
Many have tried, no doubt.
And the pine nut trees have beautiful bark as well. It's one of my favourite barks.
They're a spectacular tree. Trees.
Yeah, fabulous.
There you go. We've been talking nuts here on Blueprint with our gathered team of experts in these matters, botanic. Tim Entwistle from the Royal Botanic Gardens Victoria, Nikki Reamer, head chef at Bellotta, and Penny Woodward, horticultural editor for the ABC's Organic Gardener magazine. Blueprint for Living here on RN.
Clumsiness is seldom seen as a virtue, but in the case of the Band-Aid sticking plaster, it's the reason why we have these handy little helpers. Earl Dixon was a cotton buyer for Johnson & Johnson, which had been making gauze bandages since the 1880s. Earl's wife, Josephine, was something of a whirlwind around the house, which often left her with small cuts and grazes. Earl gradually became fed up with dressing her minor wounds and came up with the idea of sticking pieces of gauze on a length of sticky tape so that Josephine could cut off whatever she required and apply it herself. They realised others might find this useful, and so Earl took the idea to his boss, James Johnson. In 1921, the company started selling an 18-inch roll of bandage with an absorbent centre and sticky edges on one side, calling it Band-Aid. It still needed to be cut to shape, so in 1924, the company started selling small individual strips, which were perfect for fingers. Sales were small too, and tins of them were sent out free to the Boy Scouts Association, the natural home of cuts, grazes and blisters. They were also put into the first aid packs given to servicemen heading into World War II, and that fuelled a sudden leap in their popularity. In 1921, a German company called Hansaplast also launched its own version of the adhesive dressing, and Britain followed in 1929 with the launch of Elastoplast. One innovation was to have the sticking plaster coiled around a core in a tin, like sticky tape for the office, so that you pulled out however much you needed. By the 1950s, few houses in the developed world didn't possess at least one form or other of sticking plasters. Playful designs printed with flags or cartoon characters were added to appeal to children, and Band-Aid plasters were taken to the moon in 1969 as part of the Apollo mission. Band-Aid came under fire in the 1960s for marketing the plasters as flesh-coloured, meaning pink. People with differently coloured skin begged to differ. A political cartoon of the time quipped, "White is a flesh-coloured Band-Aid." In 1998, a brand called Ebon-Aid was launched with a range of colours to suit African-American skin tones, but sales were low and the company soon folded. As every child knows, applying a plaster will always make things better. But the name Band-Aid has passed into generic use, often describing a temporary intervention that covers up something more serious. In 1984, Bob Geldof named a group of musicians Band-Aid when they released a fundraising song for the Ethiopian famine. Who knew that cutting a finger might eventually feed the world?
Colin Bissett there with yet another iconic design. And that's it for this highlights package from Blueprint for Living Just Past. I'm Jonathan Green. We'll talk again same time, same place, here on RN.